This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 19, where we review the 1983 film, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20TH. We post our next movie selections there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. So we're going to do something really special this week we've never done before. This is a movie/book review.
Woo! With special guest Spencer. Can you hear him purring into the microphone?
We have a cat sitting on the laptop.
Rubbing his face on my mic.
Yes.
Really, cat?
This is why we don't have more followers. This kind of thing.
It's your fault, Spencer. Yeah.
So I read the book for the first time this past year, and I loved the book. And I remembered the film and said, this could be just something different. You know, we have 20 episodes in the first season, and just to kind of break things up, it sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's just do something unusual. Maybe do a book film review.
Yeah, I like it. Well, you know, books are one of my love language, so I was down for that.
Yeah. Are there any other book movie combos you can think of that if we had not necessarily a science fiction or horror fantasy thing, just in general, that would be a fun podcast to do?
I mean, where do you start? Like, I'm a lover of the classics. Mm-hmm. I'm doing air quotes for the audio. and I mean, almost any classic book novel you can think of has been adapted to something, you know, some sort of visual media at some point. So, I mean, I think that list is long.
Yeah.
You could do a lot of podcasts on book versus movie adaptations.
I think something that would be fun. I really enjoyed the book Tarzan. There's been so many different movie adaptations of that book. It would be fun to do like a Tarzan series where you read the book, you know, review it, and then review all the different Tarzan
adaptations.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Similar to Jane Austen or Shakespeare.
Yeah, that's true. So what have we been watching lately?
Honestly, I don't know if it's been a busy week. I can't remember watching much other than I know we saw a few more episodes of an HBO comedy that, again, we're behind on or behind the times on because that's how we roll.
Yeah. Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Silicon Valley.
The writer creator is Mike Judge.
Is that Beavis and Butthead?
Yes, he started with Beavis and Butthead and then went on to do Office Space.
I could totally see that.
And then Idiocracy.
Oh my gosh, Idiocracy. We were just talking about Idiocracy the other day, right?
We see Idiocracy happening everywhere.
I think my words were, that is the most underrated yet prophetic movie of the past, two decades?
Yeah. Yeah. If you haven't seen Idiocracy, I strongly recommend you watch it. It's a brutal telling of the future that was done out of, you know, comedy sake. But
There's a lot of SNL folks in the movie, isn't
right?
it? Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, don't expect high art going into this. This is not a high art recommendation, but it is sadly true. It's a look at basically a dystopian future that looks a little too similar to our current day situation.
Yeah. It was released maybe 15 years ago, something like that. Several things that they've predicted have come true.
This is not a family-friendly movie, just for the
anything
record.
Mike Judge is not really
family-friendly.
This show that we're talking about is the same way. It's not, I mean, a lot of profanity and
this is not a family. Silicon Valley is not for the family to watch. Yeah, just so know that. In fact, the most recent episode we watched was probably the most disturbing to me. It was a little too much.
But if you've seen Office Space, I think this is like a continuation of that type of comedy.
For the 2000s, right? Office Space was clearly happening in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. Late 90s Office Space world. I don't know. I'm in the IT world and he kind of gets that sector of the population.
Yeah. He
really gets that, you know, our generation.
Yeah. So Gen Xers.
Yeah. Kind of middle age, you know, just office cubicle environment type workers.
Yeah.
He kind of gets that sector and that humor's
like,
dead on.
Yeah. Rated R Dilbert, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is. It's really what this is.
Tell a little bit about the premise behind Silicon Valley.
So there's these, I don't know, I'd say they're 20-somethings.
Yeah.
move to, obviously, they're IT startup guys, and they've moved to Silicon Valley to try and make it big. Either work for like a huge IT company that's their name is everywhere, kind of like a Bill Gates type or something, or a Steve Jobs type, but then maybe write their own code that's going to make it big for them.
Really early in the first episode, this guy has written this amazing compression algorithm that can change the internet as we know it.
Right.
And he has a choice. He can take big bucks from a mega company, like, you know,
sell out, basically.
Microsoft, Oracle, you know, somebody like that, a big
Hooli.
Company.
Hooli. Hooli's a big company that's going to buy him out, possibly.
Or they could try to do it on their own as a startup company. And so the whole show is basically them saying, we're going to do this as a startup.
Yeah.
All the legalities involved, them fighting the big corporate America, because the big company doesn't like to be turned down.
No, exactly. And they want your product. Like, they don't want you to make it as a startup. They want that to be their new platform.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I found it very stressful. In fact, I was going to mention that we had to take a break between season one and season two. Because when season one ended, we were like, I don't know, Mike Judge is good at making you feel the angst and the pressure of that environment, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you felt it in Office Space, too.
Yeah.
You were like, ah, this workplace is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you having worked in the business world and in the IT world, like... Mm-hmm. It's very true to life, right?
Yeah, it is true to life.
I mean, they obviously take it to an extreme, but there's a lot of truth and humor there, right?
Yeah, and it's legit. I mean, all the terminology and the things they discuss is like legit IT lingo.
Wow. So, yeah, that I wouldn't even know. It sounds legit to me, but what do I know?
The comedy's dead on, but there's stress involved too.
Yeah, it's pretty high stakes situation, and we had to take a break.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're wimpy like that, but... We needed a palate cleanser.
So we just kind of described our demographic. You know, we talk about Mike Judge gets this sector.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked last week about Wes Anderson. And I think he gets that sector too.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He gets that sector and probably the upper class he gets pretty well too.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah.
Or at least he knows enough about him to make fun of him.
Yeah, very true.
You know, you think about the directors who kind of get, you know, our demographic. I think it's probably, it's just funny. It's Wes Anderson, Mike Judge.
Yeah, it's maybe a sad commentary on Gen X, but that's where we are, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say people like Tim Burton, like, we love what they do, and I think we're drawn to that for sure.
Yeah.
But it's definitely kind of more a gothic take on it.
Right, right.
You know, they get us, but more of a gothic spin. You know, they kind of pull you into that section of the world.
Is he just the same, but he was the kid who played D&D in high school?
Maybe.
Like, and we're friends with those people, but we weren't really part of that group. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah. All right, so today's 20th century movie we're going to discuss is Something Wicked This Way Comes, produced by Disney in 1983. It was a PG dark fantasy movie based on Ray Bradbury's dark fantasy novel. They are relatively similar, so, you know, spoiler warning, we're going to talk spoilers through the movie and probably hit some of the book spoilers too, because we'll start talking about the book more towards the end of our discussion. So, you've been warned. So based on the 1983 movie, we start out in the little sleepy town of Greentown, Illinois, where we have two 12-year-old boys, Will Holloway and Jim Nightshade. They're neighbors, they're best friends, and they are becoming aware that something weird is happening with their town. Some kind of ominous presence is coming. And it seems like maybe their dad, Will's dad, is a little bit aware of it too, but everybody else just kind of has a hint of like, oh, there's a carnival coming or something's coming, and you're not really aware of what's happening. But then, boom, a carnival does come to town. It's Mr. Dark's Pandemonium something.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was carnival, a long name. Yeah, Pandemonium Carnival. Is that what it was called? It seems a little more than just a fun time carnival, right? Like, creepy things are happening. The adults are kind of being sucked into wanting to live in their past or be younger. And it seems like the boys are the only ones that get it. Like, this carnival is not just a carnival. Something wicked This Way Comes.
Title drop.
Ha.
And who is Mr. Dark?
He is basically a soul hunter, I think, is what his purpose is. Like, he goes around, you're kind of signing a deal with the devil if you join Mr. Dark's carnival, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're selling your soul. And so he realizes the boys are on to his plot. So not only does he want to grab as many people as he can from this town and move on, he definitely wants to grab the boys because mm-hmm. they're going to spoil his fun if they get away with it.
I first saw this as a young kid. I think I saw it once, maybe. I remember a few scenes that kind of stand out to me, when I rewatched it recently.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being creeped out by it, but I didn't think it was the greatest movie in the world
right.
at the time, but I didn't think it was bad.
Right. So it was just creepy enough to probably get your attention at that age, right?
It got my attention. It scared me a little bit. There was some imagery, like Will's head gets chopped off, in a basket or something. He sees his own head there. And freaks out.
I'm going to point out that his head doesn't actually get chopped off, but he sees maybe a dummy get its head cut off and it has his face or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he stays alive.
There's a guillotine as part of one of the carnival freak show things.
Mm-hmm. So things like that freak you out. It's a Disney movie and you see a beheading.
Right.
That's a little unusual for Disney for
the 80s. Yeah, actually, I wanted to quote, I think it's like, on Rotten Tomatoes, of course you can go in and read all the critics' reviews of everything, but they give you, like in the movie info section, they give you kind of like a summation of, like, or I guess it's under the topic of the critics' reviews. They give you like a summation of all the critics' reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting. The critic consensus is what it's called. It says, true terror and typical Disney wholesomeness clash uncomfortably in Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh.
So I don't know who that's attributed to, if Rotten Tomatoes themselves writes that. Mm-hmm. after they read everybody's critic reviews, I don't know. But that came from Rotten Tomatoes, and I thought it was funny because it is, mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and say, like, I did read the book and also watched the movie, and there's a bit of a clash here. The book is much more terrifying than the movie, and I guess we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Now, when's the first time you saw this movie?
Okay, so I thought maybe, like, it seemed familiar when I saw the previews and stuff. I thought, maybe I did see this. We had the Disney Channel when I was a kid, and I watched creepier things there. Like, what's the Return to Oz? Is that like the, continuation of Wizard of Oz? That was real creepy. So I thought, oh, I probably watched this too. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I did. I didn't remember. Once we watched it, I thought, no, I don't really remember enough of this. So I must have been aware of it, but just never.
Right.
Never watched it.
Well, we'll get to the production issues here in a second, because you touched on something that I think the whole movie production struggled with, was how scary do we get?
Yeah.
And I think the filmmakers were pushing for a darker, scarier film. Disney saw what they had and then did reshoots. They spent a lot of money on reshoots.
Oh, really?
And try to, make it a little more family friendly, less dark, less
dial
scary.
It back into the Disney territory.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Now, when I was reading Something Wicked This Way Comes, one thing that stood out was the book is dedicated to Gene Kelly. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ray Bradbury first wrote this story as a screenplay. And it was after he watched Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain from 1952. Ray Bradbury thought, this is the greatest musical ever. And I want to do something as a setup for Gene Kelly.
Okay.
Kelly loved it, shopped it around, but nobody was really interested. Because you think Gene Kelly, Singing in the Rain, but then you think of Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Was he going to play Mr. Dark? Was that going to be Gene Kelly's role?
I would imagine he played Mr. Dark or Mr. Holloway,
Yeah, he's got to either be the dad or the bad guy, right?
But it did not take off, and it just got basically put in the can, And Bradbury then adapted it to be a novel and then released it.
Oh, okay. So he did like a screenwrite first, a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't happen. And he's like, well, I'll turn it into a book.
Right.
I make better money off of the books. Anyhow, they don't want to buy my movies.
And then for years, he still wanted to make it into a movie. And it really didn't materialize until the 80s with Disney.
Wow.
It coincided with Disney wanting to get into the realm of more mature films. And this was their big jump into kind of family-friendly horror.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So like I mentioned before, Disney didn't like their first cut. There were some scenes they took out. They didn't like some of the special effects. You know, the scene where they had the tarantulas coming out after the boys? That was filmed with 200 live tarantulas and several fake tarantulas.
No way.
And it was filmed like a year after the original shooting was finished.
Oh, really?
Because in the original take, they had a big dismembered hand that was reaching down and grabs the boys and pulls them towards Mr. Dark. And apparently that effect did not look very good.
Interesting.
And then also the music, they didn't like the score. They felt like it was too dark, too scary. So they fired the composer, they fired the director, and they brought in another guy to do those reshoots I was talking about.
Really?
And then they brought in James Horner to do the music.
Okay.
And James Horner, you know, he did that score, which we thought sounded a lot like Star Wars.
Yeah, I kept hearing just the beginning of Darth Vader's march, right?
Yeah, I was like, dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
dun,
dun, dun. I was like, dun, wait, dun. It's Darth Vader's going to come out.
Yeah. He got his big break in a movie we reviewed earlier this year, Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, in all fairness to James Horner, I thought the soundtrack was okay. It did sound a little too reminiscent of Star Wars.
Yeah.
But in fairness to him, he had to throw it together very quickly.
Oh, wow. Yeah, a tough spot to find yourself in, for sure.
One more thing about this film. So they spent $5 million on those reshoots, and it brought the total budget up to $20 million.
Okay.
And it was really a flop in the theater.
Ugh.
It only made back $8.4 million.
Oh, okay. Like that was their net, or that was the gross?
Gross.
Oh, ouch.
So okay. They lost big money on this.
Okay, that's problematic. Yeah.
Okay, time for us to give some high fives.
Yep.
I'll give a high five for the ability of this film to create a kid-friendly, creepy mood.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great introduction to horror for little ones.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
We reviewed a movie earlier this year called The Monster Squad.
Right.
And it also is similarly like an introduction to horror. But it's, I would say that's more of a teenager introduction to horror.
Yeah, there's a lot of like kids using foul language, rebellion against authority kind of thing. Whereas this is a little even softer intro to the horror genre than that.
Yeah. I think it has scares and creep factor, but isn't too much for children. And I'll give you some examples, some things that kind of, you know, freaked me out as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When the Dust Witch is slowly making Mr. Holloway's heartbeat go to the brink of death.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, death is scary for anybody, but especially for a little child, and have a witch making your heartbeat go slower and slower.
And you had seen her not just as this creepy witch. You'd seen her as several different personalities through the film. So sometimes she was actually very alluring and like you wanted to know her. And then other times now she's like basically killing your dad, you know, or bringing him right to the edge of death.
Yeah.
That's pretty creepy.
Yeah. Another scene that was creepy is seeing the lightning rod salesman strapped to an electric chair and getting electric pumped through his body.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty rough.
I think an electric chair in general, you know, growing up in the 80s, I remember there was a Metallica shirt that had a guy in an electric chair.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Ride the Lightning, I think it was the name of the album. I remember Wes Craven having a movie called Shocker. It had a guy in an electric chair. So there was a lot of, in the 1980s, we lived in Florida, and we had Old Sparky. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was our famous, infamous electric chair here in the state of Florida.
So I think the symbol of an electric chair, especially for us at that time, was very ominous.
Yeah. Well, I think even now, like, electric chairs are gruesome. That's a pretty rough way to go. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another moment that was particularly creepy, seeing that adult man, what was his name?
Mr. Cougar.
Mr. Cougar transform into this creepy, expressionless little child.
Yeah. And I think the creepiest part of that for me is that Mrs. Foley, the school teacher, just assumed that was her nephew. Like she's been duped by this and lets him into her house.
Yeah.
That's even creepier to me. Like the evil that's there and you don't even know it. You know? He's pretty creepy.
And there's that scene where she goes blind and she's at his feet.
Oh,
and she's like grabbing his pant leg and he's looking down expressionless. And then suddenly he smiles. He's happy.
Yeah. All of a sudden he has an expression and it's not a good one.
Yeah.
It's not a happy smile. It's a creepy smile.
So those are moments I would classify as like kid-friendly, creepy horror moments.
Yeah. I don't think we sold that as kid-friendly, though. We just sounded genuinely creeped out by that.
Well, as an adult, I was creeped out by it. But I would say, again, it's not objectionable. It's scary.
Right, right. But not over the top.
Not over the top. Jonathan Pryce as Mr. Dark.
Oh, yes.
Now, we love Jonathan Pryce in other films. I mean, he's a tremendous actor.
For sure.
One I'll throw out, Wolf Hall. It was a miniseries. Yeah. He played a cardinal. Who was the famous British? So it was King Henry and...
Right. Henry VIII. Cromwell.
Thomas Cromwell.
Yes.
Yeah, it's his story. But anyway...
You scared me there. Like, I wasn't going to know some British history. I got nervous. I started sweating a little.
But anyway, Jonathan Pryce, he has a suave charm about him, but he can turn into a devilish menace very quickly.
He's sneaky.
I mean, he looks really tall and handsome, so there's something great and gentlemanly about him.
Right.
But then he's got this other side.
And he wears a tux and a top hat. He's, you know, like, he's walking into this podunk little Americana-type town, so he looks very debonair and...
Yeah.
Like, we should pay attention to him, right?
Somebody we can trust.
Right.
But obviously...
Or probably knows better than we do, you know?
Yeah.
He's more educated and more cultured and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, some of my favorite scenes involving Mr. Dark, when he offers Mr. Holloway the ability to be 30 again, and he starts tearing the pages away one at a time.
Oh, yeah.
That moment was like, I don't know, as one who's, you know, I'm 43 now, I mean, I wouldn't mind being 30 again. You know, I'm one that I can put myself in the shoes of that character.
Yeah.
And I'm just seeing, like, he's pulling away years of the life that potentially... That Mr. Holloway could
and
enjoy.
And to know that this was, I mean, everybody that's older probably has those moments of, I mean, currently me, right now I'm dealing with a little bit of a back issue and I wish my back felt a little younger. But I think in this context in particular, he knows that Mr. Holloway deals with this fear of, it's like an incapacitating fear that keeps him even from connecting with his own son because he knows he's an older father.
Yeah.
And he has trouble, like, he feels like he's not being the dad he should be because he's not young enough to go out and play baseball with his kid or, you know, go throw the football around or whatever. Like, he constantly battles this feeling of ineptness.
Yeah.
And Mr. Dark knows that. Oh. So he's like saying, hey, but I've got the golden ticket right here. I can make you young again and you won't have to deal with these problems. That was something.
Another moment when he's working on Jim Nightshade, trying to entice him, even saying things like, you know, this could be Dark and Nightshade's pandemonium carnival. You know, just trying to woo him over. And there's a part of you, again, you put yourself in Jim Nightshade's shoes. He is looking for a father figure.
Exactly. So that's what we don't really get into, I don't think in the book or the movie, is how does Mr. Dark know these things? Does he do his research or does he have some sort of omniscience? Like, because he's evil, he just has some sort of knowledge of your basic fears. I don't know. I don't think it really digs into why Mr. Dark knows this. But again, Mr. Dark knows that Jim's insecurities come from not having a father.
Yeah.
And so Jim wants nothing more but to be older, to have some sort of connection to an older male figure. And he plays on that.
Yeah.
Like, he just picks that apart, you know? Like,
yeah.
You can be my partner in business. You'll be a grown businessman doing your thing, you know? And it's effective. It's effective.
And then again, in the library, he said something that I put down here that I thought was really cool. Funerals, bad marriages, lost loves, lonely beds. That is our diet. We suck that misery and we find it sweet. We search for more always. We can smell young boys ulcerating to be men 1,000 miles off and hear a middle-aged fool like yourself groaning with midnight despairs from halfway around the world.
Wow.
So when you were saying just a minute ago, how do they know things? I think they're like a bloodhound. They smell blood. So even when the witch was looking for the boys, there's some scent that they're giving off, something that she hones in on.
Yeah, fear and regrets and whatnot.
And then when Mr. Dark's looking for them in the library, he doesn't know where they are exactly. But he starts wandering in their direction.
Yeah, he does. And he starts saying things that would make the boys more fearful. Like, oh, your mom was at the carousel. You know, she's basically, you're never going to hear from her again. You know, like, it's going to make the boys, it's going to evoke more and more fear in them. So maybe he does like a scent, a pheromone or something.
Yeah.
You give off.
But yeah. So definitely a big high five to Jonathan Pryce in this role.
Yeah, for sure. He was creepy. So another high five I'm going to, well, first I want to give a high five to the town itself. I think they filmed this in Vermont.
Yeah.
I don't know if we know the name of the town, but I think in the novel, and of course, obviously they wanted to go for this in the movie, is we want to see, it's very much in the novel, it's clear that we're dealing with a very quaint American town that gives that like Main Street feel. We've got bricked main streets and, you know, sidewalks, and everybody knows everybody, and kind of everybody knows everybody's business. And this little town, this picturesque town in Vermont that they filmed in, was perfect for that. Like they they literally had like bricked Main Street, little town, little shops, you know, the cigar shop and the barber and the local bar. And then this was all supposed to have taken place in October. Like, you know, you get Bradbury does such a good job in the novel of painting that picture of like the air turning crisp, which we don't really know about in Florida, but we've read about it enough. I expect that Octobers in other places are different.
Yes.
So like this crisp air is starting to come in. The leaves are changing colors. The breeze is blowing. Leaves are kind of swirling around. And they totally captured that in the cinematography. So I did really like, even from the opening scene, you see just this beautiful, quaint, picturesque, you know, town of all these fall-colored trees. And they nailed that. They really got that well. Okay, my final high five goes to Jason Robards. He plays Will Holloway's dad. He's Charles Holloway. He's and really, that's the whole story is really focused around, especially coming from the point of the novels, really focused around Will and his dad, Mr. Holloway, and then, of course, his best friend, Jim, and then Mr. Dark. And everybody else is kind of a side player, right?
Yeah.
So I think Jason Robards did a really good job of acting against Jonathan Pryce's Mr. Dark. He's just good. He looks like a sad older man, you know, and he's kind of wise to the ways of the world, but kind of dealing with that inwardly and not letting his son in. And Jason Robards definitely plays that off well. You know, you can see why he kind of is introspective, keeps to himself. He feels guilty for not being more involved in his son's life because he feels like he's too old or he doesn't know how to connect with a young boy, you know, whatever. But the son just wants his dad to be a dad, just wants to talk to him. Like, he doesn't care if he comes out and plays baseball or whatever. So there you get do get a good sense of that tension between their relationship, you know. So I feel like he did do a really, really good job with that, but then still was able to rise to the occasion and match wits against Mr. Dark, which, as we know from the novel, which we'll talk about, we needed Mr. Holloway to be the hero in the end, you know, and that's what Will needed in his life too, was to recognize his dad as like, he is my dad and he will stand up for me.
There's a another, I'll read some more from the movie because I think this interaction with Mr. Dark is really good. This is in the library. And you hear Jason Robards, he feels the presence of Mr. Dark, but he hasn't seen him yet.
Right.
This, of course, is from Macbeth, you know, Shakespeare.
Right.
By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. And then Jonathan Pryce's character, Mr. Dark, is suddenly seated right behind Jason Robards.
Right.
He says, then rang the bells, both loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. And then Jason Robards says, the wrong will fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Which Mr. Dark says, it's 1,000 years to Christmas, Mr. Holloway. And then he's responded with, you're wrong. It's here in this library tonight and can't be spoiled.
Yeah, that was probably the most powerful lines, really, in the movie.
I guess this is a point, and we'll talk about the book a little later. This is the point, and where I do think their interactions, that essence was captured pretty well in the movies.
Right. Mr. Holloway, he is the library custodian. And when he can't sleep at night, when he's wrestling with his demons, he goes and sits in the library and reads and kind of sequesters himself, you know. So this is his time to shine. Like all this reading and quotes that he's been memorizing or whatever, like this is your opportunity to go head to head with Mr. Dark, who's been around who knows how long. We don't know how long this guy's, you know, been in existence, right?
Yeah. High five to Jason Robards.
For sure.
So let's get into low points, and I'll get us started there. I would say the fact that they had to do reshoots and switched things up, and we alluded to this earlier,
right,
that it made the plot confusing.
For sure.
If we hadn't read the book,
exactly,
there would be a lot that I think we would be scratching our head about. Plot is kind of jumpy. It takes points from the book, tries to incorporate them, but doesn't explain them very well. And I have a couple examples I wanted to throw out.
Sure.
So the Dust Witch takes away the boys' voices as she does in the book. Mm-hmm. But at no point do they mention that that goes away or that she has to lift it or that it's just a temporary spell.
Somehow the spell is broken. Yeah, exactly.
So in the movie, you know, the boy shows up in the mirror maze and calls out to his father. Suddenly he has a voice.
Exactly.
And they never really explain.
Why does he have his voice?
Why does he have his voice?
It's in the novel, it's very clearly depicted. You know why the spell is kind of broken on him.
Yeah. So I just wonder, like, why even throw that in there?
Yeah.
So the lightning rod salesman, when he breaks free and kills the dust witch by throwing a lightning rod into her, it really doesn't make any sense.
No, and that's, well, and it's funny to me, you're calling her the dust witch because that's what she's called in the novel, but I don't think even once do they ever refer to her as the dust witch in the movie.
Right.
Which again, whereas the movie has just kind of dropped some of the elements from the book, so it's hard, I think it would be especially hard to follow the plot. You're going to be left with a lot of questions if you haven't read the book. Mm-hmm. And then, like we're doing, you're kind of automatically, if you have read the novel, you're automatically kind of filling in those holes and saying, well, that doesn't work because we know this from the book. Mm-hmm. You know, but you're filling in holes that the movie created for itself.
Right.
So it's tough. That's tough. It's a little jumpy.
Yeah. I mean, she physically, like, materialized in several different places. Mm-hmm. So she has to be kind of ethereal in form. And then for him to just stab her to death.
Right.
Like, again, it doesn't make any sense.
No, and I felt like they lost out on the creep factor with her in the movie, honestly. Mm-hmm. She probably is one of my biggest low points herself. Mm-hmm. Because in the book, it's almost like she's a mummy or like a fake, you know, like in the movie Big with Tom Hanks, where like he goes to the genie, but the genie is like a mannequin in a box, right? Yeah. You put your quarter in and he says his things and whatever. Mm-hmm. I felt like in the novel, that's what she was. She was almost like a dummy, you know, but then she had the ability to move and she was blind. They called her the blind dust witch. Mm-hmm. In the novel, like her eyelids were sewn shut or something because she's just a dummy. She's not real. You know, she had like sewn fake eyelashes or something. Mm-hmm. And so it made her even creepier because she's fake, but yet she had the ability to like drive a hot air. I don't know if fly a hot air balloon.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do with a hot air balloon, but she had the ability to like fly a hot air balloon over their house and, you know, all these things she could do.
That scene where she turns into like a mist and visits at their house in the movie and kind of starts attacking them.
That was the replacement scene.
Right. In the book, it was a hot air balloon. She was actually flying over and marks their house.
Yeah.
So the bad guys know where they live.
It marks Jim's house.
Yeah.
And specifically, and Will has to, again, rise to the occasion and wash off the mark from his roof.
Yeah.
But you lose all of that in the movie, which is a disappointment to me. Like, I felt like the dust witch, and here I am using air quotes again for people who can't see me. but she lost a lot of her creep factor in the movie that she really had in the book. Like, she was so hard to pin down and figure out in the book, and that's what added to her authenticity and her creepiness.
Yeah.
That just wasn't there.
Yeah, they decided to go more of a femme fatale route.
Yeah, yeah.
And Pam Grier is, you know, obviously gorgeous and
sure.
So I kind of understand going that way with a visual medium like film, but you're right. It does lose something. The book definitely has, you know, a mummy looking lady with her eyes sewn shut. That's pretty darn creepy.
Right, right. But still she has like physical abilities to really inflict. You know, because she's that in the book, but still can like slow the dad's heart and take away the boys' voices. Like, that's real creepy. This fake mummy looking character still has some sort of mystical powers. That's real creepy.
Yeah. You know, one other scene, and we'll get to this when we talk about the book a little more, but the ending is very different in the book than the movie. Like, the way they still defeat, obviously, Mr. Dark and his crew. But in the movie, at the point where Jim falls, Will starts crying, and his dad's like, "No, that's what they want. We need to laugh." And he starts yelling at his kid.
Right.
And it was a little hokey in the movie.
Yeah. And it was real just kind of out of the blue.
Out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So in the book, they set up all this story for that. Like, they really set it up so much better. Because at the demise of the witch, the dust witch, is really real. Well, actually, when she starts trying to slow his heart down and starts to try to kill him in the library,
right,
that's when he starts figuring out
he starts putting it all together.
That, like, he can defeat them with positivity.
Exactly. They're feeding off of our fears. We're letting them have control. He starts putting all, from all of his cataloging of information from working in the library and spending nights in the library, he really has started to realize, like, oh, this is what is happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a chance to spell that out in the book.
Yeah.
Like, this is how you defeat these people.
Right.
Or these entities.
Uh-huh.
But in the movie, you kind of just jump to that conclusion.
Yeah.
There's no reveal of, like, why is he yelling at his kid to start laughing and stop crying? He thinks his best friend is dead. You know? Like, that seems weird.
Yeah.
Like, again, please don't be my grief counselor.
Yeah. Did you have any low points?
I just feel like in the movie, they really missed an opportunity. What's so, so strong in the novel is this... these missed opportunities with the father-son relationship and mm-hmm. that kind of, it's just such a human element to the book of this, you know, pride and fear getting in the way of true relationship. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't pull that off in the movie. They couldn't bring that to bear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you really miss out on that in the movie, is that strong connection between the father and son. There is some there. I mean, there's effort
mm-hmm.
where you're seeing that the father and the son clearly have kind of missed each other somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And the dad rises to the occasion and the son kind of sees him as a hero in the end. But then, you know, there's this whole side plot in the book with Jim and his lost relationship with his father because his father's gone.
Yeah.
And just how that almost did him in. And you don't really get that in the movie. They miss that, you know.
No. In the book, like you said, it dives in so deeply with the father-son relationship. You see people our parents' age or older, and you don't have this because your dad does a great job communicating. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, like my father, he didn't have a gift for communication, right, expressing feeling. And I think it was even worse for their generation.
Yeah, sure. I mean, don't they even call that the silent generation? Like the generation before our parents was the silent generation?
I think so. Yeah, that would make sense. And so there's this tension that's fueled by their inability to communicate in the book.
Right.
And in the book, about midway through, they have a breakthrough in their communication.
Yeah.
And I was so emotionally invested. Like, I actually, like, started breaking down and crying.
The conversation is so deep.
Yeah.
I mean, in just such a real sort of way.
Yeah. Because for half the book, you see them both struggling and you just want to intervene on their behalf. Like,
right. Like, just talk to your kid. He just wants you to talk to him. He doesn't even care what you say.
And so finally they do have this conversation before really all the action kicks up into high gear and they get on the same page. And it's such an amazing part of the book. And in the movie, it's just lacking.
And oh man, I could probably weep too, just if you wanted to really dig into the novel and talk about what comes about in that conversation. And ultimately Will has to ask his dad, like, am I good? And is mm-hmm. that enough?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot to dig into there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that just, the movie never has a chance to go that deep.
No, no.
And it wasn't intended to. I mean, it's a Disney movie with, you know, just like a little Disney's Haunted House kind of element to it, you know?
Yeah.
That just a little bit scary, but not really scary.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't intending to go there. But man, Ray Bradbury's book definitely goes there and it's fantastic.
I would love to see another adaptation of this movie.
Right.
Some of the other cast, you know, we mentioned Pam Grier as the Dust Witch. She does fine for what she is doing. She relies a lot on just her visual appeal and then just ability to also look mysterious and creepy.
Yeah, and she kind of appears and disappears at will, so that kind of adds to her mystique.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. What do you think about the two boys, the kid actors?
I mean, I think they were believable as buddies. I can't mm-hmm. say they were like stellar actors or anything. I have no idea where they are now. I don't know if you've looked them up, but
yeah, they don't. I haven't. They don't have Wikipedia articles about them. So
this may have been the only acting they did, or
maybe But they did fine.
No, they were fine for 12-year-old boys. They were, you know, what you'd expect out of 12-year-old boys. I think. So
they weren't necessarily endearing, but they weren't awful either.
No. Yeah, the boy who plays Will Holloway, he reminded me so much of the boy from Christmas Story.
Oh,
you know, you're gonna shoot your eye out.
Yeah. Blonde. Just the way he looked.
Yeah.
The lady that plays Miss Foley, the teacher, She does pretty well. We had just seen her a couple days ago in Pollyanna.
I forgot about that, yes. Oh, that's a movie we didn't talk about earlier. We did see Pollyanna, or we saw part of Pollyanna.
Yeah. You must have watched with one eye open, because you looked asleep on the couch.
I was asleep for most of it. We came home from dinner, and your mom was here watching the kids, and watching Pollyanna with the kids.
Yeah.
And I lasted for about 10 minutes of it.
But yeah, that teacher, she did a pretty good job, right? The
She was. We joked because she has a very distinctive old lady face that did not match her younger face when she got transformed into her young, beautiful blonde self.
Yeah.
If she
went from that young self to that old self, there had to
had
be
some hard living.
There's some drugs or something very awful that went on
things,
in the middle.
Some bad things happened to her, poor lady. But acting wise, she was pretty believable. Like she was desperate. She'd seen some hard times and was very much alone, I think, was a lot of her. If she was that young, vivacious, beautiful blonde that she turned back into because of the carnival, she probably had a very fun, fulfilling life. And for some reason, she's ended up this old, lonely maid living by herself, you know, school spinster type person.
Her name's Mary Grace Canfield. She's spent most of her time as a character actor. So she does this really well.
Right.
It's very similar to what she does in Pollyanna.
Yeah, she's grouchy and cynical. And,
yeah. All right, final summations. Is this a yay or a nay? What say ye, Kim?
Gosh, so if you're going to read the book, I say it's a yay.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, why not? If you're going to read the book, you might as well see the movie, right? Yeah. Is it like, if you're not going to read any Bradbury books, I think you don't have to see this.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Like, it's fine, but you don't have to see it.
Right. Like I said, it's a good introduction to horror. If you're a horror buff and you're like, I want to show something to my kids, I'm tired of watching
Pollyanna.
People don't say that anymore.
Oh. Nobody started watching Pollyanna because no one watches Pollyanna.
Exactly. But yeah, I would say if you want to introduce your kids to horror, this is a good one. I would say yay, just because I really enjoyed the Jason Robards, Jonathan Pryce dialogue. But you know, you're talking about maybe 20, 25 minutes of the movie that really makes the movie. And the rest of it, I agree, like you wouldn't have to see. You could, if you want to cheat, you could go on YouTube and look for those scenes in particular.
Yeah, that's true.
So now's the point in this podcast where we're going to talk a little bit about the book.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, we've expressed our opinion that the book is way better than the movie.
Yeah.
But let's go through some of the differences. And I think the biggest difference is the third act. We've already touched on it a little bit.
For sure.
But describe and how they defeat the Dust Witch in the book.
Okay, so like you said, in the movie, we see her just get impaled by a lightning rod salesman, you know, with a rod. But there's so much more to it in the book where, you know, she comes into the library that night. She's going to slow down Mr. Holloway's heart. He's putting all of this together. He's done his research. You get to know that through the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so he realizes, like, I don't have anything to be afraid of here. Like, that's what they're living off of. They are getting power and energy and you know, basically ahead of us because of our fears. And so he realizes, like, if I laugh in their faces and show them I'm not afraid of them, I have regained the power in this situation. Mm-hmm. So that's what he does, basically. He laughs at the witch, and she's kind of thrown off of her game and has to leave the library. And it's almost like she's wounded.
Yeah.
Just because he kind of smiles at her like, wait a minute, you don't know me. You don't control my life. Get out of here, you know?
Yeah. And then that really serves as an epiphany for him. He gains the confidence he needs.
Exactly.
So then he goes on the offensive. Following them to the carnival.
Yeah, falls to the carnival. There's this whole, like, last trick shot that Mr. Dark's going to do for the crowd that's gathered there. And he asks for a volunteer, and Mr. Holloway shows up and is going to be the volunteer. Well, he knows what this whole game is about now. So he's able to basically see through the whole ploy of this, like, you know, fake. It's the whole shoot the gun and then the witch, you know, shoot at the witch with the gun. And instead of killing her, she catches the bullet in her teeth.
Right.
When in actuality, he marks on the fake wax bullet that's going to dissolve mm-hmm. in the rifle barrel. He marks it with what looks like a crescent moon, but it's a smile.
Yeah.
And it's basically letting the witch and Mr. Dark know, like, no, the gig is up. Like, yeah. I know what's going on here, and you will not control me or my son or his friend or any of this town anymore. Mm-hmm. We're onto your scheme.
Yeah.
And so he pulls the trigger, and in any other carnival act, like, that wax bullet would have just melted. She has the real bullet in her hand, pops it in her teeth, and smiles, and the whole mm-hmm. crowd's like, what? How'd she do that?
Yeah.
So she does that. Smoke's cleared. She's got the quote-unquote real bullet in her teeth. But then you see her, like, stumble backwards. I say see her yeah. as you're reading the novel.
It's described in the book, yeah.
Right. And basically, Mr. Dark has to kind of explain to the crowd really quickly, like, no, she didn't get shot. She didn't get shot.
She's in shock.
Mm-hmm. Basically, she dies because Mr. Holloway was able to say, nope, not on my watch. Yeah. We're not scared of you anymore. And he just carved a smile, basically, mm-hmm. on the bullet. And so, and that explains, like, later when they're going to defeat the Hall of Mirrors, mm-hmm. he has to tell Will, like, no, Jim's not going to die if we can laugh. We can't cry. We can't let them see our defeat. We can't let them see us be afraid.
Yeah.
We have to laugh and hoop it up and make them see that we're not afraid of them. And that's mm-hmm. ultimately what rescues Jim.
Yeah.
But you miss all of that in the movie because it's yeah. rushed. And we did this weird thing where we had to impale the witch instead of, like, defeat her with a smile and yeah. knowing that we're going to be okay. You're not in control. You know?
Mm-hmm. Another key part of the book that they touch on in the movie is this carousel. Mm-hmm. The carousel that if it progresses, you age in forward, but if it goes in reverse, then it backs up your age.
Right. Yeah. You get younger. That's how Mr. Cougar ends up being the nephew of Miss Foley.
Right.
De-ages himself.
And Jim so desperately wants to be older.
Yeah.
And so he is very much drawn to this mm-hmm. Apparatus. He wants to get on this thing and get older so that he can do all the fun things in life that adults can do. He can stand on his own. He won't need anybody.
Right. Because he's been missing a father figure for all these years. And
yeah.
He wants yeah. to be a man.
It's so much of Jim's story in the book. They touch on it, obviously, in the movie. But I don't know. It resonates in the book.
Yeah.
And even that interaction between Jim and Will. Will is very terrified of Jim leaving him behind.
Yeah, he is.
And this is like the ultimate in leaving somebody behind. I mean, you are good for a little boy. Mm-hmm. If your friend were to suddenly age way past you, that is really leaving
you
behind. Yeah, if
you're 13 going on 14 and now your friend is 19, 20.
Yeah.
You have nothing in common anymore.
Right.
And he's gone from your life.
Yeah.
And you have to remember too, like, this was still at the point where Will and his father, their relationship is a baby fledgling little thing. They've mm-hmm. only had this one great conversation. Mm-hmm. So Jim has been Will's life support, you know, through most of his childhood years. So if Jim mm-hmm. all of a sudden is 19 or 20, he's gone off to the land of adults.
Yeah.
And Will really is left alone.
Yeah. So that carousel plays a much bigger role in the book.
Oh, yeah.
And then for the demise of Mr. Dark in the movie, Mr. Dark gets on the carousel and gets older and older and older.
Right.
Until he's like, you know,
like
just
a corpse almost.
Shriveled up corpse.
A mummy, yeah.
Well, in the book, a little boy appears and tries to trick our good guys, right?
Yeah.
And they recognize him as Mr. Dark in a young form.
He comes running in basically saying, like, I found Mr. Dark. You have to help. He's doing mm-hmm. something to somebody in the field, you know?
Right.
But they realize, like, nope, Mr. Dark just made himself younger on the carousel. This is him. Yeah.
And I forget which character does it. It might be Will's dad. But one of them hugs Mr. Dark.
And I think, like, it is Mr. Holloway, Will's dad.
And he's hugging him and loving on him and laughing and basically kills this little boy.
Kills him with kindness.
He literally kills him with kindness, which if you saw that in a movie, that would be pretty brutal to see a grown man, like, basically hugging and laughing at a little boy while he is dying.
Do you think he actually died? Because I felt like in the book it was, because the like one of the other carnival freaks comes and like picks up his body and carries him off into the darkness. Yeah. So was he like dead or was he like incapacitated Voldemort? You know, when Voldemort's weak and can't like do anything without help.
Yeah.
I kind of felt like he was like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's not really spelled out.
Yeah, I think what they get, and this is just me speculating, is they get a go at it until the season changes. And then they're removed. So if they get taken out of this world, they're done, but they're going to come back.
That's true. In the movie, they refer to them as the Autumn People.
Yeah.
Like, they come around at this season of the year. I don't know if in the book, do they call them the Autumn People?
I don't know, but that's definitely a cool term, the Autumn People.
Yeah, and it's an interesting concept. Like, you know, they kind of come in on the winds of the Halloween season, you know?
Yeah. Well, some terrible storm comes and takes them away each time they leave. So it makes sense to me that they would, sometimes they have a big bumper crop of souls and that they come and take. In this case, they got defeated, but you get the feeling that they're going to be back.
Yeah, you don't feel like they're completely decimated.
Right. Like, there's a loose end that's not really tied up in the book. The teacher, she becomes a very small child. And then it also is turned blind. There's more interaction with her.
Yeah, in the book, they stumble upon her when they already know kind of what's going on. They hear, they're walking through town. They're on a mission to do something. I don't remember what it was. And they hear crying coming from like a little courtyard area or something. They find this little girl blind under a tree crying, and she just needs help. She needs help. And it's like takes a few minutes. And Will and Jim finally realize like, oh my, this is Mrs. Foley. This is our school teacher. She's been transformed into this little girl that's helpless.
Yeah.
And they were like, they're in the process of trying to figure out how to defeat this whole thing at that point anyhow. So they tell her like, stay here. Don't move. Don't move. We're going to come back for you. And I don't remember exactly what all happens in that timeline, but they do go back for her and she's not there anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't think it ever, we never come back to her in the book, do we?
Yeah. You don't really know what happens to her.
Yeah.
And even in the movie, I don't think they spell out what happens to these other characters.
Right. Do they get released from their, whatever they've been turned into?
Yeah.
Are they like carnival freaks now? They have to travel with the carnival? I don't know.
That is something I will warn you, because I looked for them in the book, but like this football player with one leg and one arm. This
He was the barkeeper in town in the movie.
Yeah, the one shop owner who really wanted to be with women, exotic women.
The barbershop.
Barbershop guy. And then the guy that wanted money. Like, he wanted money very badly.
He was the cigar shop guy.
Yeah.
In the tobacco shop.
They don't really call them out specifically. I think that's called out, you know, for our benefit to show that, like, these are terrible things. Like, it's kind of like the monkey's paw story where you'll get your wish, but it's going to come at an awful price.
Yeah, all magic comes with a price, as the crocodile told us in Once Upon a Time.
Another Disney production.
Yeah, very true, very true.
All right, now's the time we're going to look at some of our comments on social media. Make sure you're interactive with us on social media, and we'll give you a shout out here on the show. Trev9F calls this movie classic. Bebo P. Jones says, I need to rewatch this with my 40-year-old eyes.
Yep.
You might be a little disappointed. E. Slaymaker says, heart, 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 the gorgeous Jonathan Pryce. Jonathan Pryce has a fan out there.
All right.
He's a good looking dude.
Yeah.
Ghost Cat Patrick says, great movie. And so they're responding to a picture I had of Jonathan Pryce as Mr. Dark.
Oh, okay.
And Bob and Willow says, Frank from Once Upon a Time in the West, which I haven't seen that.
No, yeah.
Roses B0610 says, awesome movie. Old but not obsolete. That's a great handle, by the way.
That's their Instagram handle?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Nice.
100% proper thumbs up. I posted a picture of the book, and the film theorists, our buddies, have another podcast.
Right.
Said, I need to read this one. I've read Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles. He's a brilliant writer and so prophetic about our times today.
Yeah, he should definitely read this one.
Yeah.
I am not a Bradbury fan because, you know, like, this is not my genre that I normally choose to read. But after reading this book, I said to you, like, I think I want to read more Bradbury because, and somehow I didn't even read Fahrenheit 451 growing up. Like, so many people, even people I went to high school with, read that in their English class, but my English class somehow,
yeah,
I don't know, we were reading other stuff.
Yeah.
British Lit, probably, because that's what I love. But yeah, so I probably need to go back and read that just to round out my high school English education.
Yeah. I think you'll find that book in particular, that story's been played out so many times.
Right.
You'll find it to be predictable, but it's only predictable because
it was the original.
Yeah, it was the original. Or at least one of the pioneers of that. So
okay.
And then the last one, Shishka Rob, which is another great handle, said, "This movie freaked me out as a kid."
Yeah, I could see it as a kid.
Yeah, for sure.
It's definitely got that dark feel to it for a kid's movie.
All right. So what are we watching next week?
Okay, next week, which is also our next to the last episode of the season, correct?
And our last film review
of the season. Our last film review of the season, we will be watching 1994's The Crow with good old, what's his name?
Brandon Lee.
Brandon Lee. It's an action fantasy. Rated R. I think it's available on HBO Max if you have that. And I have not seen this before, which is kind of shocking to me because that was my high school years when this came out. But somehow I missed watching this in high school.
Oh, it has 1990s written all over it.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody I knew saw this. Everybody I knew talked about this. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to watching that one. I haven't seen that one in many, 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 many years. So I'm looking forward to watching that again with 43-year-old eyes, just to see what it's like, see how it holds up.
Almost 44-year-old eyes.
I know. We're not there yet. Yeah, and that will be our swan song for the season until we will do a 21st episode that's the awards show. And I think we're going to call it the attackies.
Yes, the attackies. I like that the word tacky is in there because I feel like somehow that's apropos. So. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun. So we're really grateful to everybody that's stuck around this long and been listening to these episodes.
Thanks for listening to us ramble. We appreciate it, guys. It's been fun.
So yeah, what did you think about this doing a book review?
Oh, I love that. I could have spent all night just talking about that book and the themes in the book, but that's all right.
Well, I guarantee this is one of our longer episodes, so we'll wrap it up.
Okay. All right. Well, enjoy your movies. Go watch The Crow. We'll see you next week. Peace out, guys.
Peace out.